Expert HR Weekly, compliance, good practice and benchmarking for UK HR professionals.
Hello and welcome to Expert HR Weekly with me, Cleo Springer. Not all dismissals fit squarely into the commonly relied on reasons for dismissal, namely capability, conduct and redundancy. Some dismissals fall outside these reasons but can still be fair if they're shown to be for what is termed some other substantial reason. But what does this mean and what kind of process does an employer need to follow if it's dismissing for some other substantial reason? Well, we're very fortunate this week to be joined for a special edition of Expert HR Weekly by Max Winthrop, a partner and head of the employment team at Short, Richardson & Forth LLP. Max, who some regular Expert HR Weekly listeners may remember guided us through the employment tribunal process last year, is also contributing author for a number of sections of the Expert HR Employment Law Manual, and of particular relevance today, the unfair dismissal section. Hello and welcome back, Max.
Hi.
Many thanks for joining us again on Expert HR Weekly. So Max, can you start by providing some clarity on what constitutes some other substantial reason for dismissal?
Well, I suppose the starting point is always going to be the words of the statute itself. So just as a little refresher, what we're interested in here is the words of Section 98(1)(b) of the Employment Rights Act. So as I'm sure most people listening will know, what that statute says is that there has to be a reason for dismissal. And you've just told us those reasons, the capability, conduct and redundancy categories. But as well as all those, there's a catch-all. And what the statute says is that either you've got one of those reasons or the reason can be some other substantial reason of a kind such as to justify the dismissal of an employee holding the position which the employee held.
That's quite a wide definition. So can you break it down for us?
Yes, I think there's two points that need to be highlighted here. The first is that the reason needs to be substantial. So what that means is that it can't be a trivial reason. And then the second thing to emphasise is that the reason must be capable of justifying the dismissal of an employee holding the position which that employee held.
So the position of the employee will be important when looking at the employer's reason for deciding to dismiss.
Yes, one of the cases put it, different types of reason could justify the dismissal of the office boy from those which could justify the dismissal of the managing director.
Well, it's quite a broad category, as you said, you'd referred to it as a catch-all. Can you tell us what types of situation have been found to be some other substantial reason?
Yes, well, certainly a variety of situations have been covered. So some of the ones that sort of immediately spring to mind would be business reorganisations, an ETO reason following a dupe transfer, personality clashes, dismissals due to reputational damage to the employer, pressure from a customer or a third party to dismiss or remove an employee, and then you also get dismissal where you've got an employee specified retirement age.
Okay, so there's obviously quite a wide range there. With the other dismissals, so ill health, capability or misconduct, for instance, there's a procedure that employers have to follow to ensure that the dismissal's not found to be procedurally unfair. With all those different kinds of reasons, how is an employer going to know what the fair process is going to be when going through some other substantial reason dismissal?
That's quite a tricky question. I think what's important to bear in mind is that what an employer has to show for an SOSR dismissal is a reason for dismissal. We've just heard that it shouldn't be a trivial reason. And because there's such a wide variety of factual circumstances that could lead to that, you've then got to kind of tailor what you do next to those circumstances. Now, remember, once you've established a reason for dismissal, the employer then needs to look at the question of fairness under Section 98(4). And it's that question that will determine what steps you take to make an SOSR dismissal fair.
And we should probably point out, of course, that the reason can't be a discriminatory reason.
That's right.
Okay. And going back to the procedure, would there be different levels of warnings, for example, before some other substantial reason dismissal, like there is with a disciplinary procedure?
Not necessarily. I think what might be helpful there is to look at one of the decided cases. The one I'm thinking of is Ezier and North Glamorgan NHS Trust. So what happened in that case was that the claimant, Andrew Ezias, was employed by the trust as an oral and maxillofacial surgeon. And probably as you'd expect, in his contract of employment, there were elaborate terms dealing with professional conduct and competence and also personal conduct. And it meant that if the trust was going to dismiss for a reason falling within those categories, they had to follow that process. Doesn't look like Mr. Ezias was very easy to work with, and he started making lots of complaints about the standard of surgery. Things got to a head, and in fact reached a point where 9 of his colleagues actually signed a petition saying that they couldn't work with him. At that point, I suppose, the trust might have been expected to go down the more normal sort of conduct type process, but they didn't. They brought in an HR specialist, and the HR specialist produced a fairly elaborate report, and he concluded it was really up to the trust to decide whether to go down the disciplinary process or to take on board the fact that trust and confidence had totally broken down between Mr. Esias and his colleagues, and proceed on that footing. And that's exactly what the trust did. They dismissed on the basis of that total breakdown of trust, arguing that it was some other substantial reason. As you can expect in something like this, there were appeals. And the point in the appeal process was that the reason itself should have been treated like a conduct type reason, and consequently all that elaborate process should have been brought in. Well, the Employment Appeal Tribunal said no. This was a case where it was clear that we were dealing with a total breakdown of trust and confidence. Consequently, all that elaborate process for conventional conduct type issues effectively went out the window.
Okay, so the Employment Appeal Tribunal in that case were quite happy that the employer hadn't been through the standard procedures.
That's right. But I think I really ought to perhaps just sound a little bit of a cautionary note here. SOS cases really do turn on their own particular facts. And now in Esias, those facts were pretty stark. In fact, you couldn't really get starker facts than that when it came to the breakdown of the working relationship. But if things weren't quite so clear cut, then I think an employer's got to be really careful about deciding what process to use and what might lead to a fair dismissal in any given set of circumstances.
And are there any particular steps that you think the employer should be following in a situation like that, the one that we've talked about?
Yeah, I think that will always depend on the type of the SOSR dismissal. So if you remember a few moments ago, I described those kind of long list of various categories of case that have been described as SOSR dismissals. And there will be, within those categories, cases where a more elaborate process is going to be appropriate.
In the circumstances of the Esias case, where there's a breakdown in relationships, what kind of steps could an employer take there?
Well, again, you might be looking at, for example, the strength of opinion. In Esias, it was pretty clear the whole department couldn't work with Mr. Esias. But supposing that was only one person out of 100, supposing there were other opportunities to move someone away from a department where they obviously weren't functioning fully, all those factors have got to be taken into account. And really, I suppose it's a question of using a bit of common sense here to decide what sort of circumstances, what sort of procedural steps are going to work.
So you might try and resolve the situation, maybe introduce some mediation or something.
Absolutely,
like that.
Yes.
Okay. And are there any particular risks attached to some other substantial reason dismissals?
Well, there can be. Where it's clear, for example, that what you're really accusing the employee of is, say, dishonesty, or it may be a question of lack of capability, then use that. Use the conduct process, use the capability process. I think some tribunals are really going to question if you trot out the old breach of trust and confidence in cases that are clearly conduct cases, clearly something else. And in those cases, really, it's use the conventional approach to the dismissal and don't rely on the SOSR one.
So a big risk really is employers over-reliance on some other substantial reason and then not following the proper procedure that they should have followed. And what about circumstances where an employee resigns, where there's a potential constructive dismissal? Can employers argue some other substantial reason there?
Well, they might want to do that, because don't forget that a constructive dismissal can also be a fair dismissal. So if the employees jump the gun, the question of having a reason for that dismissal might be important. But also, if an employee does resign, don't forget that that might just be exactly that, just a resignation. And if so, the employee's not going to establish a constructive dismissal claim.
So that might be a situation where perhaps if an employee walks out during a disciplinary process, that might be due to the way the process has been handled. It could be a breach of trust and confidence, or it could just be a straightforward resignation.
Absolutely. So sometimes an employee might try and preempt an employer making a finding of misconduct by leaving before the process has been concluded. Sometimes the employer's process may be so flawed that the employer would be entirely justified in walking out and treating the employer's actions as a fundamental breach of contract.
So I suppose you could apply the same principle to an employee walking out because the employer is going through a business reorganisation process, and again we're talking about the employee jumping the gun.
Yes, in those circumstances the employer might want to defend the constructive dismissal claim on the basis they had a reason. In this case, that SOSR was the business reorganisation. So that if there was a constructive dismissal, open to argue that that dismissal was a fair one.
And it would have to be able to show that it had good reasons for the reorganisation that led to the employee's resignation in response.
Absolutely.
To that. Of course, we should point out that employers need to be mindful of the other risks around possible reorganisations, or if that's going to result in changes to employment contracts, that employees may bring damages claims in the civil courts if their contracts are changed. And of course, that there is also a correct process that employers should be going through when they want to bring about changes to contracts, whether or not that's due to a reorganisation. But we'll come back to that in a little while. Moving on to a completely different scenario, what about where a third party is refusing to allow one of your employees to come onto your premises, so effectively leaving the employee without a role in the organisation? Would it be fair in those circumstances for the employer to treat that as a some other substantial reason dismissal? And what kind of steps would the employer need to do in that sort of situation?
Yes, that would definitely fall within the SOSR rubric. In terms of what sort of steps the employer would be expected to take, there's a useful summary of that in a recent case called Massini and Compass Group. And what the tribunal sort of set out there in its list of things to do was that the employer should explore the third party's view, that the employer should potentially challenge that third party's view if it's appropriate to see if the dismissal could be avoided. The employer should consider redeployment to another post, and also the nature and the extent of the injustice to the employee arising from that third party's decision.
And are there any other significant cases around these third party type, some other substantial reason cases?
Yes, Sarah, I mean, I suppose the classic one is probably Dobby and Burns International Security Services. So what happened there was that Mr. Dobby worked for Burns International Security at Liverpool Airport. The airport was owned and controlled by Merseyside County Council, and in the agreement between Burns and Merseyside, the council had reserved a right to approve or remove anybody who was employed by the company. So, for reasons that the judgment doesn't explain, unfortunately, Mr. Dobby fell out with the airport's chief security officer, and the council said, OK, we've had enough, he's got to be removed from the airport. So that case went to the Court of Appeal. What the Court of Appeal said was that the tribunal was entitled to conclude that third-party pressure here could justify the dismissal. It was a some other substantial reason. But the tribunal hadn't necessarily looked carefully enough at the question of what the injustice suffered would amount to. So that really what you're looking at here is those range of factors that we mentioned previously, connection with Massini and Compass Group. So again, length of service of the employee, how satisfactory the employee's service had been up to the point when somebody asked for his removal, what alternatives there are to dismissal. Another important factor here would be what it says in the employee's contract. If third-party pressure is likely to be a real issue, should it be something that's included in the contract of employment? This is a way of sort of pre-warning the employee that if you antagonise our best customer or whatever, you could end up facing removal from site.
So those sort of principles that you've outlined there are really very typical to any kind of dismissal, really, aren't they?
They are, yes.
Now, moving on to yet a different situation, where an employee's been charged with a criminal offence and is in prison custody, do you think that would come under the some other substantial reason banner, or would we call that something else?
We certainly could call it some other substantial reason. And there's a case called Kingston and British Railways Board where exactly that label was used. And again, another Court of Appeal decision. What the Court of Appeal said there was that a prison sentence can be an SOSR reason, but the employer needs to consider the nature of the offence and the length of the sentence to decide whether or not a dismissal for that reason would be a fair dismissal.
And of course there might be cases where the conviction is directly related to the employment.
Yes, so that could be a reputational issue, or it could be an honesty issue within the workplace.
The potential conduct there.
Absolutely. And of course don't forget that a prison sentence itself might also amount to an example of the doctrine of frustration coming into play in the contract of employment.
You mentioned reputational damage there. Presumably that would be the issue where an employee is potentially convicted or charged with a criminal offence but isn't necessarily in custody. The employer might still treat the reputational damage as a reason to dismiss for some other substantial reason.
Very much so. So there will be certain types of offence where, even without a conviction, the association of that employee with that type of behaviour could damage the reputation of the employer, and in those circumstances, as I said, even without a conviction,
that might be enough for the employer.
That might be enough for an SOSR reason.
Okay. We talked earlier about reorganisations, and which can result in potential changes to contracts and employee resigning, and this being some other substantial reason, constructive dismissal. But there is a process that employers should be going through when they want to bring about changes to contracts. And those changes might be, for example, changes to hours or introducing a restrictive covenant. The correct process is for, first of all, for the employer to try negotiating the agreement, but if that fails, as a last resort, they may have to terminate with notice and reoffer the job on new terms. Presumably the employer will be wanting to argue that this is a some other substantial reason dismissal.
Yes, certainly. Some of the earlier cases looked at that in terms of a fairly heavy burden on the employer. I think the best way of looking at it now is that there has to be a discernible advantage to the business in the changes that are being proposed. And then, as you said, there's a process to follow. So in the classic reorganisation, you'd expect to see a degree of negotiation. There'd be notice, there'd be termination, and there'd be a reoffer of employment on fresh terms.
And the employer would then hopefully be able to rely on some other substantial reason as being the reason for dismissal.
If it followed all those processes, then that should be clear.
And could the level of support for the change among the workforce make a difference?
Yes, it could do. I mean, that's what happened in a case called Garside and Laycock and Booth. So in that one, you had a company in economic difficulties and they proposed a relatively modest cut of 5% to the wage bill. They had a ballot and 77 of the employees accepted it, 7 abstained and 4 rejected it. So in that case, because of that level of support, the tribunal was quite behind the employers in what they were doing, and that those that refused to follow on were held to have been fairly dismissed.
So that was a relevant factor in that case?
Very much so, yes.
And consultation with employees is going to be the key here, isn't it?
It certainly is. And don't forget that we're in an area where, in addition to the individual rights those employees have, if we're talking about a set of circumstances that affects 20 or more employees, then we're into the realm of collective consultation. So as well as the individual, you're going to have to make sure you comply with the obligations with regard to collective consultation.
Okay, important to mention that. The last situation I want to have a look at is a situation that's not that uncommon, where so there's a couple where they work for the same employer, but one leaves to work for a competitor. And the employer's concerned about the relationship and the risks to the business. For example, they're worried about there might be a leak of confidential or competitive information, and they want to dismiss the employee who's left behind.
Yes, that certainly could be an SOSR, but I think the point to emphasise is that you have to look at the risk to the employer. It can't be just a fanciful risk. There has to be some real risk of damage to the employer's interests. And so that's going to probably only involve employees quite high up the hierarchy, or those employees that really have access to information that's genuinely confidential.
So it's necessary to identify that real and genuine risks there. And presumably also the employer should be looking to find alternative employment for the employees.
Yes.
rather than dismissing them if that's possible.
Very much so, yes.
Okay, Max, thank you very much indeed for that very interesting look at some other substantial reason dismissals.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And you can find out more about some other substantial reason dismissals, as well as the other potentially fair reasons for dismissal, in the Expert HR Employment Law Manual. We also have how-to guidance on dealing with a situation where a client refuses to have an employee back on its site, as well as relevant model documents. And that brings us to the end of this week's Expert HR Weekly, which you've been listening to with me, Cleo Springer. We're back next Friday, but until then, it's goodbye from us.
Expert HR Weekly, the latest from experthr.co.uk, the award-winning subscription service for HR professionals.